Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Diana Dini.
And this is Mojan Sohi. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Mojan. It's great to talk with you again. We were talking about our past experiences and where we've been working, kind of getting to know each other better, which I really appreciated. And I understand that you have worked at several different sizes of companies. So startups and medium-sized companies and big companies. And I know from, especially from the quality side, the way quality is managed in all those different sizes of companies is different. So I wanted to ask you about your experiences with reliability programs in those different sizes of companies. Like, how are the reliability programs different from a startup versus a really well-established large company? Because I know there's got to be some. Can you tell me a little bit more about your background? And
yeah, absolutely. And thank you for suggesting this topic. I think it's very, I am obviously very vested in it, and I think it's very fascinating. And yes, I do have experience in various size teams and companies. And it's been very interesting over the years to see how they vary. Overall, I would say the things that are common are that everyone wants to get from concept to, you know, a fully like production ready product in a short amount of time.
I think we
can all agree everyone wants to have that very fast. So that's common. And I think, but what is different is, of course, you know, resources that are available at smaller companies versus larger companies to be able to throw at the product development throughout the different stages. And I have found, and you know, in some cases, I think rightfully so, that at smaller companies, well, first of all, of course, like, you know, of course, there's less resources. So that means there's fewer, you know, variety of expertise that is around. And so when they're working on developing the product and such, it's very much like, what do we absolutely need? You know, like you're really heavily trying to prioritize.
Yeah, because especially in those startups, and like you said, resources is a problem. Mm-hmm. But it's more that, and you mentioned the knowledge base of the resources, the knowledge that's available, that's also could be limited. So you have mm-hmm. people working, especially probably on reliability, that maybe aren't necessarily reliability engineers officially, but they've mm-hmm. self-studied and found some things, but they're wearing multiple hats. So they might be developing the process and working with the OEM manufacturer on supplier quality, and now they're also doing reliability engineering. I've seen that a lot. Is that what you've done in the small businesses? Have you had to wear a lot of hats?
Yes, absolutely. And yes, I have seen the same thing. I think oftentimes people are working in various capacities like a reliability engineer would, without really realizing that, you know, it falls within the scope of what would nominally be reliability engineering. So yeah, I completely agree with that. The other thing I think that I've seen is that, interestingly enough, I think at startups, because of that, you know, you may run into problems sooner rather than later, which for better or for worse, it kind of calls for, you know, teams to be like, interesting, that shouldn't have happened. How do we prevent that from happening again? And so it kind of broadens the reach. And usually, you know, sometimes reliability engineers kind of come in at that stage. Or maybe, you know, they come in through other, you know, through the kind of the niches, for example, it could be like, hey, we need a materials person because we need to learn about the material here. And then maybe the materials engineer, for example, is more also aware of how that ties into reliability, for example, or from a testing perspective, for instance. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah. So you're saying that you see a lot of, I wouldn't say it's false starts, but a lot of feedback loops where everybody's going along, they think it's going well, and they hit a failure and they realize that there's a gap somewhere and they have to come back and fill it.
Yes.
Yeah. And even not just the startup companies, but if a company doesn't have that institutional knowledge about whatever they're developing, they could be at risk for that too, where they don't have the experience or the understanding of what they're developing, just that it's new. So yes, I've seen a lot of times where that's where reliability engineering consultants can come in, and material scientists can come in if they have that particular problem. So yes, I've seen that too.
I think one of the things that I think would be very interesting is to actually get stats on some of these things, because part of what I've seen with larger companies is that the thing that they can do differently, because and understandably so, I think the thing that they can do differently because they're able to have the resources to have full teams for being able to for address, you know, just working on reliability, for example, is that they do have more long-term plans as well. So they can kind of set up this infrastructure for reliability that you know, may not necessarily that is kind of feeding into, you know, what, for example, getting data from their customer base 3 years from now, you know, maybe 4 years from now, kind of thing, or maybe 2 years from now. So that kind of ability to be able to set up the infrastructure for later, I think, can come in at larger companies because they are able to add resources. Whereas what I've seen also at startups is that they're very much like within the next like 6 months, like we just have to solve this problem, you know, because we have to get a prototype out, you know, so that we can for demos and for, you know, investor reviews and such for the next, you know, 6 months. So it's kind of like these 6 month portions at a time, which is, you know, very understandable. But that is another factor that I've seen, which kind of has, you know, different implications. So I have tried when I've been at with smaller teams to help figure out when you are in that situation, you know. But it's also very key to kind of think about those long-term plans, because a lot of design decisions are made early on that would be more difficult to change later on. You know, things like if you want more sensors and, you know, how to package them and think about the software setup and, you know, what signals are you able to get from your device. If you make those decisions early on, it's a lot easier later. But of course, you know, it just really depends on the team and such.
Yeah. It sounds like you are brought in, especially with these smaller startups, that you're brought in as the expert reliability engineer and materials engineer. It sounds like you help them to pause and think more longer term strategically for their designs, just to get them to pause and think more strategically. So.
Yes.
So when you're working with them to do that, I imagine that you're talking with them about the current reliability problems or the test issues that they're coming up with or their current plan. And I'm sure that you introduce that. Is there a particular task or person within that small company that seems to really take on your suggestions and helps think longer term? Is that more of the product manager or the business owner?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say it's more the business owner. You, or at least it starts with the business owner. Typically, I mean, of course, it depends. You know, how small of a team we're talking, but in really small teams with startups, it is usually the business owner, I would say. I mean, they are at those stages, you know, so involved with the product development anyways, and they also have to think about long-term. So I think it kind of naturally positions them in that role to be open to thinking about both in like, how do I solve the problem today, but also like, you know, what do I need to set myself up for? How do I set myself up for success for later?
Yeah, I had done some work for a medical device company, but I wasn't the primary reliability engineering consultant. They hired somebody else to, and they were small and scrappy and very agile. And in much of the same attitude as what we're describing here, just a short term, lots of design loops, bringing in experts when they need to. And that's just the way that it goes, right? It's not that it's wrong. Just happens to be, seems to be the case of these smaller companies. But they had brought in a really good reliability person to help them develop testing. And the reliability just wasn't in their wheelhouse. They weren't that familiar with it. So they asked me to come along and just review what the other reliability engineer to make sure that it was like standard practices. And that it would be okay for regulators. So I knew this other reliability engineering person. I mean, he's really excellent. So that was a really strange position to be in. So, you know, I would do literature research and just give them, I don't know, they needed reassurance that this was the right thing to do. So even though it's one of those cases where you know what you don't know, you hire the expert help, but you're still not sure if this is the right way to go. And I can see that especially with reliability engineering topics, because we're talking statistics and probabilities and accelerated testing. And if you're really not familiar with it, it does seem a little bit woo, right?
Yes.
It's like a black box. You want us to do this and then we'll get this answer. So what are some of the things that you've done to kind of help walk them through that learning curve? And were they excited to adopt reliability things or not really?
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that. I completely know exactly what you're saying. It is very much like a bit of a, you know, magic to people. I think initially, I think people are, I don't know if I would say they're excited. I think they're kind of
okay. Like, I wouldn't either.
Yeah, I think they are cautiously optimistic at best, is what I would say. They're just like, okay, sure. You're saying that's, yeah, we can do that, sure. And then, so I think just kind of walking them through, you know, the tools and. You know, if even something like a DFMEA, right? Like you kind of just walking them through that and like breaking down the functions and then thinking about the failure modes and then, you know, what are we going to do about this? I think that in itself, once they realize that they just sitting through that exercise, what I've seen happens is that they look at them. They look at the outcome, which in my experience, you know, many of the times it ends up being, oh, we have like a, you know, we really need to select a different material here. We didn't realize that level of exposure is there, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so I think seeing that in come out of a, you know, like this particular structure of reviewing risks is helps them be like, okay, you know, and they, so they get kind of a little bit one step closer to seeing what the impact is. And then, you know, usually after that, there's the next phase is testing. So then they get through testing and then, you know, results come up. And typically if, you know, if it's been done well, then your tests should show what you are expecting, or at least, you know, show you something that is like, oh, wow, I didn't, you know, that's, yeah, we definitely need to solve that problem. That's a good problem to find. So seeing that the impact of the analysis and then seeing the impact of the test results is always helpful for people to gain a little bit more confidence. The biggest thing that I've seen is, and this usually happens, of course, when you have the data, right? Once you've gone through testing or you have there, unfortunately, you know, there's been an issue and you've gathered the data to now try and do forecasts of like, yeah, okay, so based on this Weibull analysis, for example, we can, you know, we should expect that the failure rate is going to increase. And this is, you know, this is how much time we have. And, you know, this is the kind of measure that we should put in place. The data I've seen, once people understand, you know, see that and then understand how to read them, you know, the tables and the plots,
yeah,
that's a big win. At that point, you know, usually people are like, okay, I definitely need to know more about that. so yeah, that's usually the trajectory that I've seen.
Just demonstrating the value of the mental analysis exercise of risk analysis to yes. develop the test, which then gives all that data, which then I'm sure they, you know, it's data that they can make decisions against.
Yes.
So, exactly. Yeah, I can see that being a very powerful trajectory for a startup, smaller company, getting introduced to reliability. Mm-hmm. Now, for the big behemoths that already have an established reliability team and a reliability program, I've had a different experience. Still some resistance, I guess, but you know. It's more like, hey, we have this team over here and we don't know what they do. Again, it's still black box woo. This reliability engineering team is calculating something weird and making us break things. That's where I've experienced a lot of pushback from the product managers because like you talked about in the beginning, they want to get it done and they mm-hmm. want to get it done fast and they're managing budgets. So mm-hmm. I mean, they're responsible for the timeline and the budget, so they have every right to ask questions, to challenge decisions. I mean, that's their job. Mm-hmm. But there was a project where it was a tube, and we were injecting fluid through it, and it was multiple lumens, and at some certain length, the tip would oscillate. So we got that design fixed so that we didn't want it to oscillate, jiggle back and forth. Mm-hmm. So we figured that out, you know, what are the ranges with this? And we did reliability testing. But then same design, but they completely changed the tip. And we were like, well, you have to do testing. We're like, why? We did all this other testing. So it was, mm-hmm. You know, just explaining like – sometimes you have to stand strong, like this is why we need to do it. We don't understand how it's going to react or what it's going to do. Mm-hmm. So at the bigger companies, there's still pushback for budgetary reasons and time. And I don't know, is that similar to what you see too? Or do you see things a little different? Is it a little easier because it's more ingrained into the culture?
I've seen the same thing. It's, it kind of goes back to, you know, what we were saying about product development timelines. I think because the timelines are getting shorter and shorter, of course, at a big company, like, you know, the extent of tests that you can do outside of regulatory and compliance is a little bit bigger, but it's still, I've been in many meetings where with the program teams where there has been pushback on the timeline for the tests that we are saying. And so, you know, part of it is, and what I get challenged with is that, like you said, understandably, that, you know, the program team has the right to be asking those questions. Do you really need to run a test, you know, for this long? Like, do we really need to run it at this level? You know, can we do something else, for example? Like, is there a lot of times it's virtual, you know, is there virtual analysis that can tell us the same thing? And so, you know, in those cases, I what sometimes I think is justified, like, well, okay, all right, like, I can maybe do a test at a different level. Maybe I do a material test that then informs, you know, part of how the component is going to behave. Mm-hmm. But then you have to, of course, there's many assumptions that, you know, that go into that. So it usually turns into like, okay, I will do part of, you know, our risk assessment with this test. I'll do part of it with this test. And this is what we will know. If we run the test that I'm saying, this is what we will know. You know, we'll have more information, of course, about how this the component is going to behave under given conditions. So are we okay with that? Are we not okay with that? And I think like kind of presenting like option A and option B with the different information that it's going to give back to program has worked well, because then program can decide.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I really like that. So it's not just talking about timelines and costs, but you're also demonstrating the data. Because that's also, oh, I mean, that's why we're doing the testing. But data is also worth it when it comes to the project timelines, in order to, you know, because success is a factor that's measured, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea to not just present this or nothing. Obviously, you want to work with people and give options, but to show it in mm-hmm. terms of what's the difference in the decision you'll be able to make and your confidence in it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because then it's more informed. And I think if I'm a program manager, I would want to know that, right? Because then I can take into account, or even the product manager, right? I can take into account the risk against the business, because, you know, reliability is a part of it, but it's not the only thing. You know, there's this other, you know, big decisions, you know, like how you meet the product timeframe, it can really impact, you know, the company's future, for instance, for example, in terms of the business. And so weighing that against, you know, the impact of other other parts of the business, I think is very, very important. So I would want to know that.
Yeah. And I know for the case of quality, I mean, that's a little more direct to the cost of products mm-hmm. that aren't made to that level. You know, that's a little easier for people to understand, to make that one-on-one correlation. But if they're not well-versed in reliability methods or techniques, then that would be a really valuable way for them to compare their options. Yeah, interesting. So it sounds like we've seen similar things between the small startups versus the big industries and how they relate to reliability. So that's been interesting. And I want to push it out to the listeners. Where do you work? Do you work in a smaller organization where you're wearing many hats and reliability engineering is just one of your jobs? Are you a consultant that works with the small companies, or are you working for a larger, maybe international company as part of a reliability team? What have you seen in your workplace? We'd love to hear. Please visit ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR for speaking of reliability. That'll take you to a place where you can leave a comment. You can record us a message. We'd love to hear from you. Fred, me and Bajan, we're all on LinkedIn also. You can find us there. And you can link to us on Sendo Reliability. So Rajan, I kind of like working at all these places. It doesn't matter to me if they're big or small or little. It's just a little bit of different approach to reliability engineering, I think. Any last thoughts from you?
Yeah, likewise. I also love learning, working with all the different sizes teams and learning about their fun problems.
Yeah. Yeah, failures are fun.
Yeah, <it's, laughs> I guess that's probably something that not everybody shares.
Thanks, Bajan. It was great talking with you. Yes.
Likewise. Thanks, Diana.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.